This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 94. Today we speak with Carl Truman about Luther and media. Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we want to thank everyone who helps to make this program possible. To read more about how you can contribute, please visit reformedforum.org/support. Welcome to another episode of Christ the Center. This is our 94th installment, and joining me today, as usual, is Nick Batzig, who's church planter in Richmond Hill, Georgia. It's great to have you on, Nick.
Thanks, Kim, and it's good to be on.
Our special guest today is Dr. Carl Truman, who is professor of historical theology and church history at Westminster Theological Seminary. He's also vice president for academic affairs there. It's great to have you back, Dr. Truman. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be back. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, today we're going to be speaking about a very interesting topic. We're going to be speaking about Martin Luther and media, talking about the changing face of media and all the different factors involved in the Reformation, and then how those can impact our understanding of what's going on today with public opinion, with the internet, all sorts of things. So we're going to dive in because it's that time of year again, coming up on Reformation Day. It's time to talk about Martin Luther and see what was going on in the Reformation. And Dr. Truman, of course, when we approach this topic, probably the first thing people think about usually is the invention of the printing press. Well, what some people might not realize is the printing press apparently was invented about 77 years prior to Luther posting his 95 Theses in 1517. What was going on in the whole era of the Reformation? And what were some of the changing factors, including this printing press, that afforded for the Reformation to actually happen?
Well, the printing press was certainly, one might say, a necessary precondition for the Reformation. For the first time, really, in human history, you had the ability to mass-produce information and transmit it in a relatively stable form across large expanses of territory. So the printing press was very important for the dissemination of ideas, and particularly of Reformation ideas. But there are a whole host of other factors also putting pressure on Europe at the time that meant the time was ripe for some kind of an explosion. There was a growing anti-clericalism. There was an increasing influence and importance of cities, a depopulation of rural areas. All of these factors contributed to the Reformation.
So it wasn't simply the printing press, as some people like to say, because they look at today and see the internet as being a huge impact, saying it's going to be even bigger than the printing press was. And they say, well, if the Reformation happened with the printing press, just think of what the church could do with the internet. But there's all sorts of factors going on back there, not simply just the printing of books, but a coalescing of all sorts of factors.
And I also think that there are issues related to the differences between the printing press and the internet that are probably theologically significant. Printing press was primarily a word-based medium. The internet seems to me to be much more image-based in its impact. And that, in some ways, is closer to a medieval aesthetic, if you like, where images were very important, as opposed to a Reformation aesthetic where it's the words that are significant and central.
Now, some of that obviously needs to be bound up with the fact that there was a shift in the liturgy and the acceptance of the vernacular in worship.
Yeah, well, Luther's theology really required a vernacular liturgy, as his understanding of Scripture as primarily law and gospel meant that assertions and propositions really became fairly central to what he understood as Christian piety. And, you know, to understand a command or to understand a promise, you've got to understand the language it's being expressed in. So Luther's theology required a vernacular expression. It was no longer something that happened, as, you know, to use the technical term, ex opere operato, because of who the priest was. It was something that the individual needed to grasp by faith for themselves.
Was there any opposition to printing books, and with it being so new, I know they had the benefit of having the Bible, and that was the big world-changing thing that came about from the printing press. But among the Reformers and Protestants, were there any that you found that were sort of reticent to have men just be publishing things, or was it fairly welcomed across the board?
Again, it depends on who you're talking about. I think by and large, books were regarded as, what I might almost say, a value-neutral thing. So all branches of Protestantism and Catholicism were happy to use the book medium to get ideas out of there. But when you look at somebody like Servetus, for example, who was famously tried and burned in Geneva in 1553, Servetus takes some years to find anybody who will actually publish or print his book, because you know, the printers could be held accountable for the nature of what they printed and published. So a heretic, for example, did not find it easy to get his books into print. Protestants found it difficult in the 1520s to get their books into England. Mm-hmm. They were often smuggled in by merchants in the false bottom of barrels and things like that in order to get literature across hostile borders. So while Protestants and Catholics, generally speaking, were very comfortable with the idea of books in the abstract, there was a certain amount of censorship and control that went on in different geographical areas and relating to different individuals to try to restrict what was getting out in print and was available.
Now, did Luther butt up against that when he wrote his 95 Theses? I've heard that he wasn't even aware that it would take off and somebody would print it. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, when Luther nails his 95 Theses to the church door, he's essentially doing nothing on the surface more radical than sticking up an advertisement for a public debate.
Right.
I don't think he had any idea in October 1517 that the Pope wouldn't be outraged when he learned about the abuse of indulgences that was going on in Saxony and come to Luther's rescue. That it struck a chord probably surprised nobody more than it surprised Luther himself. But that's a good example, of course, of how, you know, 100 years previously, he'd have stuck this note up on the castle door. Nobody outside of Wittenberg would have heard about it. Mm-hmm. It can be quickly grabbed, translated, printed, and distributed in a way in 1517 that it could not have been done so in 1417.
Hmm. That's actually fascinating. But at the time, since Luther wasn't really a controversial figure, wasn't attempting to be one, it seems as if, you know, he wouldn't have run into those issues with censorship, but those would have come later. Did he find difficulties in getting his books published later after he had been excommunicated, or was there enough of a following for him or support for him in Germany that he didn't have much of an issue getting his books published?
He was something of a cult figure, particularly in electoral Saxony. So getting stuff published within Saxony was not a problem. At all.
Right.
Not a problem at all. We know from the early 1520s, Lutheran books are arriving at Paris, are being smuggled into England. So he's becoming a European-wide figure. And it was a relatively safe exercise as a Saxon printer to print Luther's books.
I'm wondering how Luther's celebrity actually came about. Was it sort of accidental to a degree because he just happened to strike a nerve with the anti-clericalism, and some of his writings seem to have been read advocating or being an advocate for the disenfranchised and the poor? He seems kind of like this guy who just stumbled into celebrity and then ended up taking it on.
Yeah, there's a certain accidental quality to Luther's celebrity status. The genius of Luther was that wittingly or unwittingly, he managed to appeal to a wide variety of people. The language of freedom that he used certainly connected with the radical peasant politics of the time. The anti-Italian rhetoric that he used appealed to German speakers of all classes who were tired of having to send taxes down to Rome. Luther has a great line somewhere about, you know, you could just imagine the overweight cardinals in Rome sitting around drinking fine Italian wine, laughing about the stupid Germans whose taxes have paid for it all. So Luther strikes a, an ethnic cord as well as a political cord. And I think he was a great communicator. He writes in a very dynamic way. Clearly, he was a very good preacher as well. So all of these things, I think, served to give him wide appeal to a wide variety of the German social spectrum at that particular point in time.
Hmm.
And he was always outspoken as well. He was a fun guy to listen to. You know, were he around today, he'd probably have been a talk radio sort of guy. I mean, he was outrageous in the things he said. He was fun. So he was somebody of a very wide appeal.
Yeah.
Dr. Truman, I wanted to ask you a question, getting back to the printing press and Protestants. Roman Catholics in the medieval church, and I guess even today, to some extent, still give their imprimatur on books. Is that correct? What could be published, what couldn't be published?
I'm not entirely up to date with that. Certainly, there are degrees of approval from the Catholic Church for books. There's a nihil obstat, there's an imprimatur.
Right.
The index of forbidden books, I think, was abolished in the 1960s. So censorship in Catholicism is no longer as strictly or rigidly enforced as it would have been, say, 40, 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess my question also had to do with, it's common in the Reformed Church to hear men often say, you know, I won't publish anything unless my sessions considered this thoroughly and they agree to all of this being published. Was that there in the Reformation with the Reformers, or were they just so zealous to get good theology out there that you don't have this series of checks and balances, so to speak?
I think one must always remember that, particularly in the Reformation, theology was very much a communal exercise. In Wittenberg, Luther would sit around his table talking theology, drinking beer with his friends. They were always bouncing ideas off each other. So there was certainly, I would guess, an informal accountability there. To what extent Luther had his work vetted by others at a formal level, I don't think that went on particularly. It was more of an informal communal exercise, if I could put it that way. Short answer is I don't know for definite the answer to that question, but it doesn't seem to me that formal vetting goes on. And certainly the speed at which these guys were able to turn things around and send them out and the unfortunate nature of some of the things that Luther published seemed to indicate that there wasn't a lot of formal vetting.
Right.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, especially when we think about our media today, and to go back to the internet, the vetting process. I mean, how would you liken this to the whole process of blogs and self-publishing?
I still think it's different to blogs or self-publishing, particularly on the internet. You know, when Luther writes a book, it's got to go to the printer.
Yeah.
The type's got to be set. Everything's got to be put in place. The book's got to be run off and bound and carefully put together.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a time delay there.
Yeah.
The trouble with blogging is there is absolutely no middleman. Somebody can type something into their computer, press a button, and suddenly it's there for anybody in the world to see seconds later. And we've all been in those situations where we've written that email and we press the send button, and a few hours later, we thought to ourselves, gosh, I wish that I'd waited 10 minutes before I'd sent that, because I would have worded it very differently.
Yeah.
I think that printing in the 16th century at least allowed for more time and thought. The instantaneous nature of the internet renders that very, very problematic. Even in the 16th century, you know, Luther produced a couple of particularly ferocious books. One in 1525... on the Peasants' Rebellion, and one in 1543 on the Jews. Very ill-advised books. I suspect, though, that the rhetoric that Luther used twice in his life is the stock in trade of an awful lot of, you know, bloggers out there who, frankly, have achieved nothing in their lives other than the ability to put together a web page. You know, Luther at least had a lot of good stuff to outweigh the two outrageously bad pieces that he wrote. The danger with blogging is it just allows you to put out an endless amount of offensive drivel without mm-hmm. anybody holding you to account whatsoever. So the mechanics of the medium, I think, in the 16th century at least forced people to think a bit more about what they're doing.
Well, not only now have we come to the point of no middleman and faster times of publishing, but we're also seeing the effects of the long form being pulled down to the short form. We've gone from yeah. books down to blog posts getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and people are even shucking their blogs now in favor of Twitter and other micro yeah. blogging formats where
yeah.
our attention span as a culture is so short yeah. that we're down to limiting our thoughts to 140 characters. Yeah. So that we've got multiple factors going on in terms of the shift in media.
Yeah, and it strikes me as the 140 characters thing is a singularly moronic way of expressing oneself.
Right.
I've actually gone the opposite direction. I used to blog on the Ref21 blog for a while, but the last 6 months I suddenly decided, no, this is too short.
Mm-hmm.
1,500 words is the minimum you need to express anything worthwhile, I think. So
right.
I've gone in the opposite direction and abandoned blog posts just to do my once a month longer article for Reformation 21. Mm-hmm. That's where I see my future lying, if you like.
Yeah.
I don't have that much that's worth saying, and what I do have that I think is worth saying needs to be expressed in 1,500 words and not 140 characters.
Well, Nick, you and I have had discussions about this, and I think we all would, I think, agree that Twitter and blogs can be good so long as we understand what they're for. The problem is, I think people try to shove everything through one media,
right.
and the media can't hold it, and we don't listen to Neil Postman and other media ecologists like a Marshall McLuhan, who are saying, no, the medium really changes the message, and people forget that. They think that I can just take, well, for instance, people are incorporating Twitter into worship now. It's just goofy.
Right. And I guess one of the struggles that I have, Dr. Truman, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is if conservative reform men don't use the internet and don't use it wisely and proactively, and, you know, I try not to be too polemical. I've made the mistake of getting into polemics in blogs on comments. I've stopped doing that. And trying to proactively promote, you know, thoughtful analysis and theology. If we don't get involved in that, if conservative reform men don't, everybody else is going to. Do you think we have a responsibility in some measure to be using the internet wisely?
I'm torn. Part of me wonders if blogging is a bit like video gaming, in that there is a vast culture of video gamers out there, and they talk to each other, and there are millions of them, but they're actually irrelevant to the way the world goes on, by and large. I'm not a video gamer.
Well, they create their own virtual world.
Phenomenon.
So you're saying I'm irrelevant. I am. I know.
Well, what I'm saying is it's a kind of hermetically sealed world.
Yes.
So there's that part of me that wonders, you know, is blogging that important? The second part of it is, I think, one has to have an understanding of calling in all this. And I've come really in the last 6 to 8 months, you know, what is my calling in life? Well, my calling in life is to be a good member of my local church and to be involved in the life of my local church. And if I have good ideas, to give them to my local church. Now, I enjoy writing, so I'll continue to knock out my monthly columns here and there. But how do I most impact the people that I care most about in my local church, the people that God has placed me amongst and has said, these are the people that you're meant to care for and who are meant to be, you know, the people that you impact for me? I don't do that through blogging or Twittering. I do that through going to church, being supportive of the church's activities.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to aspire to be some sort of world-famous, world-influencing figure to do that. I don't need to blog. I don't need to Twitter. I need to be there on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if this fear of, well, if we don't blog, we won't have an impact on the wider world. Part of them will say, well, so what? Maybe you're not called to have an impact on the wider world. Maybe you're called to have an impact upon the local church where the Lord has placed you, or in the denomination where the Lord has placed you. So So those are the kind of questions that I would want to raise, I think. I have fun writing, and frankly, I do it for myself because I enjoy doing it. But my real calling is to the people I'm with on a Sunday when we gather for the Lord's worship.
Yeah, I think that's important for us to always understand that. We don't want to shun the media entirely, but we do need to understand our calling. We do need to be more humble, understand, and not everyone wants to hear what we're going to say.
And I have to agree, at some level, there are men who have great influence because of sermons, because of audio sermons, because of the internet, and yet their congregations are not lively. And I'm not saying that, you know, a healthy congregation is automatically going to be huge and lively because, you know, it takes the work of the Spirit of God and it takes time. But you do wonder about certain men who do a lot of conferences and their churches are not very vibrant, that they're spending so much of their energy on everything outside. And you wonder if they're not trying to reach the local community through the local church by spending most of their time there. And I think that is a real danger.
Yeah. I mean, Luther is a great example of this because he's a world famous and influential figure. But what drove him to Reformation? It was the fact that there was some cheap huckster selling indulgences in the neighboring parish to members of his church. It was because he cared for the local people that actually he was catapulted onto the world stage. He never sought that. What he was trying to do was look after the local people that the Lord had placed under his care. So Luther's a great example, I think, of, yeah, he's a famous, world-famous guy, but he never aspired to be that. He just wanted to be a good pastor.
Now, speaking of, Nick just brought this up, but in terms of the culture of celebrity, we certainly have one that's alive and well, even in Reform circles. Who were the types of people that people looked up to? What was the form of entertainment during the Reformation? What did people go do when they wanted to be entertained?
Well, obviously, in the 16th, 17th century, you have some great dramatists, people like Shakespeare and company. But I would say that preaching itself in the 16th and 17th century was seen as a form of entertainment by many. I mean, Luther becomes probably, you've heard me say this in class, Camden, Luther probably becomes the first pin-up of modern times. By the time you get to the Diet of Worms, there is a trade in Germany in Luther posters. I facetiously joke in class that if you've got a teenage daughter in the 16th century, the thing you most dreaded was not a picture of a long-haired rock star appearing on her wall, but a picture of this crazy monk from Wittenberg.
Yeah.
So Luther does become a kind of iconic celebrity figure, preaches to packed houses. If you look at the pamphlets and the woodcuts of that day, you can see that Luther and his opponents, depending on whose side you were on, were the great heroes and champions of the day. Famous woodcut of Luther dressed as Hercules. Here is the hero of the Reformation cast in the uniform of a hero of classical Greece. So Luther was most definitely a celebrity of his day.
There's a drawing of Luther that Albrecht Dürer actually did when they were together in the castle in Coburg, overlooking the city. Luther was in hiding. I think it was during the Augsburg Confession was being presented, and it really gives you something of an idea of how famous he was during that day. That this great artist would be there with him and drawing these portraits of him there.
Oh yeah, yes, it's the equivalent of having a top photographer following
you
around.
The paparazzi.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for young ministers who are aspiring to have a writing ministry or to have some aspect of writing involved in their ministries with regard to publications, if not internet work, otherwise? Do you have advice you give your students in this regard?
One of the things I say to my students is, I just say the first thing I do now when I get a job application for any job at Westminster, I Google the name. I want to see what these people have been up to on the internet. And if they've been unpleasant or offensive or behaved inappropriately, guess what? They don't make the shortlist for the job. So my advice to students is think very carefully about what you put up on the internet. I was very fortunate that my youth was spent at a time when the internet was not around. And I said wrote some pretty stupid and bad things, but they're gone forever. On the internet, they live for all eternity, it seems. Mm. So be careful about that. I think be careful about how you express yourself. I was given advice years ago by an older Christian guy, a guy called Bob Horn, who was a real mentor to me back in the UK. Sadly, he died a few years ago. But Bob's comment to me was always, the problem always comes with the adjectives. When you write a piece of prose, be careful which adjectives you choose, because they can be some of the most destructive things you put down on the page. Mm. An argument can be made, can be turned from a good, powerful argument into a very vicious one by the inappropriate use of adjectives. Mm. So I think self-control and thought is key. I also think beware of how much time you waste on these things. I'm told, I don't have a Facebook account myself, but I'm told that Facebook can be an incredible consumer of time.
Oh, yeah.
I think pastors and students need to ask themselves, is this an appropriate way to spend my time? How long is legitimate to spend on these things? Am I neglecting my family or my other duties because I'm typing up trivia on the internet?
Earlier on, you mentioned you briefly mentioned the early church and the difference between the internet and the printing press. Obviously, being the internet is of course tending toward visual media now. The video seems to be taking over. Christianity, at its core, I'm convinced, and it has to be, is a word religion. Now, we have been given a visual media, if you want to call it that, in the sacraments. But we have been given, you know, Jesus Christ is the Word, and faith is passed on by the preaching of the Word, the preaching of the gospel, and faith comes by hearing that gospel preached. But in the ancient church, for various reasons, people started worshiping or using icons and other types of media, visual media, in the worship of the church. But it seems like with the Reformation, was there the shift back towards word media? What happened to the visual forms, the visual representations, once the religion was back in the vernacular?
Well, in Lutheranism, the visual form continued, really. There is certainly a shifting of the pulpit back to the center of the church's life. Often, literally, the pulpit would be moved and put more central in the church building. But in Lutheranism, images remained intact. The aesthetics of Lutheranism are very similar to the aesthetics of medieval Catholicism. In Reformed religion, there was a great suspicion of the visual and an application of the Ten Commandments that really saw portraits or images of Christ as being illegitimate. So these were often smashed up and disposed of, as were stained glass windows.
Hmm. Do you think that the internet is causing or contributing to a shift back towards visual forms in worship?
I certainly think it can't help. It doesn't help a word-based religion for a number of reasons. One, clearly visual aesthetics are much more important on the web than typically they would be in a book of print, if you like. We're all aware of what web pages look attractive and which ones don't. Secondly, I think it's the nature of reading on the web that people read shorter sections and skim read. There isn't the same engagement with the text that you have if it's a book sitting in front of you. I still, for example, subscribe to the hard copy of the British magazine The Spectator because I like to sit down with a cup of instant coffee. I can't drink the American stuff. I like to sit down with a cup of instant coffee and read the magazine in a way that if I try to do it on the internet, I simply don't get to grips with the arguments and the information in quite the same way. So I think the internet, it promotes aesthetics and it shortens the attention span, sort of putting it very simplistically.
It's odd. We can put a book, an identical book on a screen. It's just odd how your brain responds differently. I just have a hard time reading anything long on a screen. And it's not because it strains my eyes or anything like that. It's just there's something different about the way we consume. And it's almost as if because I spend my time on the internet, you know, watching, you know, TV clips or doing other things, it's like my brain is expecting that type of thing when I go to it. So even if I try to get a book on it, my brain is already expecting passive entertainment in short form.
Yeah, and you know, I've switched to reading so much on Google Books now because just about everything pre-1923 is out there. I mean, books I looked for years up until 2 years ago are now available for free online. You couldn't find these books. And yet there is something very different. I don't understand it. Why, when I read a book in my hand and read print on pages, I seem to comprehend it better.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why. I don't know if what Camden said. Do you have any thoughts about that, Dr. Truman?
No, I'm sure that some psychologist out there could probably give a more scientific or rigorous answer. I wonder if it's the computer screen just reminds us of the television, perhaps.
Yeah.
And we're expecting more of a television idiom of entertainment. I just don't know. Now, I've never tried reading on one of these Kindle devices that I see popping up on planes these days. It would be interesting to see if you have the same problem with Kindle, because there it does seem that you get a page reproduced pretty much as it is on paper.
The light behind it makes it very difficult. Maybe it has to do with, you know, the fact that it's not print on paper, but it has to do with the light imaging and the way we receive that. I mean, it's different. It's different.
Regardless, we need to be very aware of the effects of media and distribution. And that's why it makes me a little nervous when we start to incorporate some of these things into the worship service. People have, even people who hold to a regulative principle of worship will have different opinions about what is a circumstance, a form, and an element. But we need to be very cautious about what we incorporate into the service, especially because it can have a massive impact on God's people, even if we think it might not. But anyway,
it's a mixed blessing on that front, though. I mean, I find strange to tell when at my own church, when we sing a hymn that isn't in the hymn book, it's printed in the bulletin and also projected up by an overhead. And I always prefer to read it in the sing from the bulletin than to look at the overhead.
Right.
But then when we come to pray for missionaries, the pastor usually has the pictures of the missionaries put up on the screen while he talks about the work they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And then we go to prayer. And I've actually found it very helpful to have the pictures of the missionaries shown beforehand. So,
sure.
You know, they're in my mind when I pray for them. So there I would say, you know, technology has proved a definite plus, that now I'm praying for people and they're real flesh and blood human beings because I can see what they look like.
Yeah.
So I found that a help.
Well, this is also coming from a man who has an icon of Gregory Nazianzus.
It is indeed. I don't have any icons of Jesus or Mary, but I've got good old Gregory looking at me now, actually. He looks suspiciously like Athanasius, actually.
Yeah,
but
I think they
Gregory
all look the same. They just...
They've all reached that stage of deification that the particulars have started to disappear.
I think rather it's an economies of scale where we have the same craftsman who makes all the same images and just puts different names on them because he doesn't want to buy them.
But Dr. Truman, I was wondering what you think about just audio sermons, the availability of sermons that are out there. I listen to sometimes 10, 15 sermons a week because I want to become the best preacher I can be and because I can learn. I mean, the men I listen to are putting in 15 to 30 hours, I mean, and then a lifetime of study behind whatever they're putting into their messages. Sinclair Ferguson, Eric Alexander, Ian Hamilton, men that are really, you know, preaching substantive messages. I've heard a lot of men take issue with the whole audio sermon craze and the dangers of people, you know, trying to replace church with it and whatnot. And I know Lloyd Jones didn't like it and didn't think it was a good thing. I, for one, am glad I can listen to Lloyd Jones every week. What are your thoughts on that? And do you think this is something the reformers would have used if they had had the same technology? I know that's an anachronistic question, but
it's a good question.
What thoughts you might have?
Sure. I think, I don't listen to as many audio sermons as you do by the sounds of it, but I enjoy listening to audio sermons because, first of all, I learn more about the Bible that way. And secondly, like you, I preach, and it's useful for me to listen to good preachers, to how they handle the text, how they move from the text to Christ, to application, those kind of things. Mm. I would certainly say that you know, listening to a CD, and I'm kind of old school, I guess. I still listen to CDs rather than download things. Listening to a CD in my car is different to hearing the word preached on a Sunday.
Sure,
it's less confrontational because I'm not there in church being confronted with the word live, so to speak. And it's less dialogical because it's not part of a service where I hear the word proclaimed, it works on my heart, and then I respond in praise with the congregation.
Yeah.
So I would see a definite difference between listening to a sermon in the car and being in church on a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say sermons on CD or as podcasts, great idea, but they're not a replacement for church, because church is more than a sermon. And a sermon in the context of a church service is more than just transmission of information about the Bible.
Right.
Would the Reformers have approved? I think, yes, they would. After all, many of them had their sermons transcribed and published.
Sure, two or three transcribers at a time sometimes.
Yeah, and of course, Luther's postal sermons were put together partly so that ignorant preachers had something to preach. So, you know, you'd go up into the pulpit and you'd read Luther's sermon, and you've got something good to deliver to your congregation. So I think the idea of allowing sermons to live on in some other media form has a long, long pedigree going right the way back to the ancient church, back to the apostles, if you like, with the recording of sermons in Acts and the New Testament. I don't think the Reformers would have had any problem with recording of sermons, but they would not have thought that just because you could get hold of a book of their sermons, you shouldn't be in church on a Sunday to respond to the Word of God in praise with the congregation.
And I think I know where you're going to go with this next question, but it's become very popular to have the video campuses with some pastor, you know, live being streamed into some campus because there's too many people to go to one. And, you know, oftentimes with church planting, they'll do this sort of thing.
Yeah.
What thoughts do you have on that?
Few things. One, I certainly think the use of video is helpful. I mean, if I can do, in some context, if I do a quick product placement here, Westminster Seminary has a Facebook page, and we now post little videos of professors talking on theological
subjects. We link to them all the time.
Right.
They're great.
So I certainly think the video media can be good for learning things from. Do I want a video link into my pastor on a Sunday? Well, I suspect if I'm housebound, if I'm so ill that I can't leave my house on a Sunday, then watching a church service on the television, if that's the best thing I can get, then that's fine. But I think the whole idea that I could replace normal church life with a video link up is abhorrent.
Yeah.
To me, bodies are important. It's important to be physically confronted by the pastor, if you like.
Yeah.
It's important to be sitting shoulder to shoulder with other people. If I can use a slightly crude analogy, if you like, at this point, I think that, you know, worship via an internet link bears the same relationship to really being in church as, you know, looking at internet pornography bears to making love to your wife.
Yeah.
Bodies are important. I may not be able to coherently and precisely express why that's the case, but there is a communal experience in church when you're standing shoulder to shoulder with people and singing God's praises, praying with them and hearing God's word preach that just can't be replicated by a video link.
Yeah,
as far as churches having multiple campuses go, I can't offer a biblical argument for this, but I think if your church is too large for your pastor to know all of you by name and to be able to visit comfortably everybody in the congregation at some point in an annual cycle, then it's too big and you need to divide your church and plant another church somewhere else.
Yeah.
Well, and I also think, and maybe you won't agree with this, but I think there's almost an arrogance, and I'm not aiming this at any one man out there, but there's almost an arrogance to think that you're the only person who can actually preach the word, that God has raised up to preach the word. I mean, there are some men that are extremely gifted above and beyond anything that I will ever be. But it just seems to me to want to say, because people want to come and hear me, let's plant a campus over here and stream me in there, is saying God has not raised up sufficient men for pulpits. I mean, I was at a church that had 200 applicants. for the pastoral position. So it seems to me that at least in the PCA, we have more men than pulpits, perhaps, you know. And so I don't know. These are just things to think about. This is becoming very popular. So
I'm very sympathetic with that view, actually, Nick. I think that it's got a lot to commend it. I think, though, that we perhaps shouldn't pin all the blame on the pastors in this situation.
No.
The big churches that I have knowledge of that have had difficulty planting churches elsewhere, it's often been an attachment by members of the congregation to the pastor that has meant they just can't get the volunteers to go elsewhere and plant a church. And that isn't really the pastor's fault. That comes down to the unhealthy, perhaps idolatrous attitude of congregants to their pastor. So, yeah, it's a complicated situation, I think, but I'm very sympathetic towards what you say. But I wouldn't want to pin all the blame on the pastor. I think congregations have to shoulder their share of the blame as well.
Right, right.
Now, we've spoken about celebrity, and we've spoken much about the church being influenced by media. Do we have any situation in the Reformation in which the church used media to influence the public, per se?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is the Reformation, if you like. The use of pamphlets extremely important. And, of course, you've got to remember that even though the Reformation is a word-based movement, most people were still illiterate in the 16th century, so woodcuts and illustrations were crucially important for getting the message out. This is where I think Luther scores very highly, because he has an instinctive grasp of how to use the media. To me, one of the most brilliant moves Luther makes in the Reformation occurs in 1519, when the church is, actually 1518, I think. 1518, the church is struggling to know how to deal with him.
Yeah.
And a man called Cardinal Mazzolini produces a book entitled Against the Presumptuous Conclusions of Martin Luther. And Mazzolini says, you know, he wrote this book in 3 days. Luther's such an idiot, I've knocked out this reputation of him in 3 days. When the book reaches Wittenberg, Luther's reaction is very interesting. Luther does not ban the book. He does not ask for the book to be burned. What he does is he reprints the book with his own reply in it, and also makes the aside comment that, you know, Mazzolini took 3 days to write this. Well, actually, I only took 2 days to write my response. What Luther does there is he uses the medium to subvert the medium.
Yes,
right.
Whereas
right.
the Catholic Church will put all of its energies in the, you know, in the 1520s into burning Luther's books and banning them, what Luther's doing, he's republishing Catholic books with Protestant introductions. He's subverting them.
Right, right. He trumps them.
Luther's brilliant grasp of satire and of the nature of the printed medium that gives him the edge in those early years of the Reformation.
How influential was visual media? Could you describe this whole issue with the Bunshoe? And was that what's going on with that and in the power of the symbol of this terrorist group?
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the Diet of Worms, 1521, after Luther has effectively stood trial and has been whisked off by Frederick the Wise, the Diet of Worms, it goes out with a whimper, not a bang, because overnight one night, a series of posters are placed around the city of Worms that simply display a peasant's boot, a shoe. And that was the symbol of a group called the Bundschuh, which is a radical peasant revolutionary organization, the modern-day equivalent, if you like, of the IRA or of Al-Qaeda. And it really puts a great amount of fear into the delegates of the Diet of Worms, who sort of slink away quietly after this has happened, because it becomes evident to them that the terrorists are right there in the midst of them. This peasant group has infiltrated right to the very heart of this imperial diet.
What was their motivation for doing that?
I think at that point in time, the peasant radicals see Luther as a champion of their cause. He's hitting out against the bloated corruption and overindulgence of the church. He's using the language of freedom. He's speaking the language of the common man. These are all things that resonate with the peasant radicals.
That's interesting. So they use a visual medium to spread their message without saying anything, thereby essentially making it possible for Luther to escape. Or to
indeed.
Yeah.
It diverts attention from the Luther problem, certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we shouldn't, I mean, the visual media is, the irony of the Reformation is the reformers are very suspicious, so say, of the visual, but they use the visual medium to present their case at every opportunity. The most famous example I can think of is Fox's Acts and Monuments, John Fox's Book of Martyrs, where the pictures were the things that made the impact on ordinary people. You know, the image of a young woman being burned at the stake and her baby bursting from her stomach and landing in the fire. That's what haunted the popular imagination. Interesting enough, a bit like modern internet pictures. I mean, who knows if these woodcuts were true or not? There was a time when the camera didn't lie. Now the camera does lie.
That's all it does.
I was going to say, a doctored image on the internet can still, you know, powerfully haunt somebody for years to come.
Yeah, we have, you know, pictures of our president in a Joker makeup and that kind of stuff didn't really happen, at least we think. Oh, that's interesting. But just to see the parallels, I mean, we just came off last year another election year here in the United States, and the whole political process is just a manipulation of media in order to form public opinion. And it's interesting just to go back 500 years ago and to see the same elements there. Obviously, it's different, but to see the same type of thing going on with these two big institutions, obviously the magisterium and then the growing Protestant contingent. So,
television, I think, has dramatically weakened the political process because it's focused on images rather than on substance. If you compare political debates and discussions of 50, 60 years ago with today, there is no comparison.
I think Postman made the case in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. He talked about the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which were famous senatorial debates for the Illinois Senate seat back in the 1860s. And they spoke of how the common person used to come to these debates and they would listen. And for 3 hours, one of the candidates would speak, and that was their introduction. And the people were able to listen and to comprehend for 3 hours and follow an argument. And the striking thing is what we have with the last election. We have with CNN, our ability as the common person not to go and to listen to a 3 hour sustained argument, but to submit our question in about 20 seconds worth of a YouTube clip and to hear about a 30-second response. I mean, the difference is amazing. Just when we think about the effects of media on epistemology, just to see how far we've come devolving just in 150 years.
Yeah. I think, I mean, talk radio accepted. The radio should be a much more intelligent medium of discourse, really, because there you're dealing, by and large, with raw ideas. Clearly, you know, accents play some role. But by and large, if you listen to discussion on the radio, you're listening to a discussion. You're not worrying about the color of the guy's tie or whether his hair looks, you know,
well, it would really be
clean or dirty.
It would really be impossible for Abraham Lincoln to be president today. Just a hideous man. It would also be impossible for someone like Taft. Well, Taft was a 330-pound president, I believe. Right. He got stuck in the bathtub.
And you saw in New Jersey, I think it was recently, the senator, I guess it's in the Senate race, the Democrat was criticizing the Republican candidate's weight, and that was his attack. This man is not capable of leading the state because this man is overweight. He's not capable of taking care of himself.
Well, that's it's part of the knock on John McCain. He's too old to be president.
Yeah, that was the big thing. I wonder, and Dr. Truman, tell me if you agree that we have more information and more knowledge ready at hand in our generation. It seems to me that, I mean, there is a wealth of resources, and yet, like you said, we lack this substance. Even on the radio, you think about the talk shows and just the nonsense that people talk about and how biblically illiterate people are and really how politically illiterate, whatever view people take politically, people don't know what capitalism is. They don't know what socialism is. They don't know what political and religious philosophies are. Do you think that's partially because we live in this television age, even though we have all this stuff around us, we're taught not to use it, not to work hard, not to labor to learn?
Partially. I think also that just the sheer quantity of you know, you use the word knowledge. I'm not sure that it's knowledge so much as information.
Right.
There is just this vast sea of stuff out there. And I think what one will see, hopefully, in coming years relative to, say, the internet is a hierarchy developing. I mean, we now know when the printing presses are firing on all cylinders in the Reformation, there's good stuff and there's a lot of garbage coming out. And over time, it became clear what the good stuff was and what the garbage was. A hierarchy developed. I think what we need to see on the internet is the development of an understanding of a hierarchy, that some web pages are reputable and reliable. Other blogs, it's just, you know, some loony in, you know, Montana's decided to set up his own web page and claim to be an expert on everything and anything.
You can email Dr. Hopefully Truman if you happen to be from Montana.
And a loony on running a blog.
So I do think we have a handful of listeners from Montana.
It's just the first state that came to mind. I don't want to cast a
well, I don't know if that does anything. I think that might actually be even worse, because you say you didn't even have to think about it to consider Montana. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
But even now I'm aware there are some web pages I can go to, and I know what the bias is, and I know what the agenda that's playing out is. But I also know that what I'm going to get there is reliable stuff refracted through a certain lens.
Right.
That the people there have, you know, they've achieved things in this field, and therefore they speak with a certain amount of authority on it. You know, it's always fairly amusing reading something by a guy who hasn't even yet got an MDiv lecturing somebody else on, you know, the minutiae of biblical Hebrew or something. You're thinking, well, if you were that good, how come you haven't got your MDiv yet?
This argument's a little circular, because when we look at who has authority in our culture, the celebrity does. But we don't ask where the celebrity got it. The authority on the internet comes from how many people read you. The trick comes, it's not from your content. This goes for us too. I mean, we're just two normal guys who decided to start interviewing people. Now, we obviously interview people who do have authority, and we don't pretend to have any on our own. We interview people, respected scholars such as yourself. But really, where does authority come from on the internet? It's numbers. And you can get numbers from all sorts of different ways. We're lacking that. I mean, there was a gatekeeper before with print media, with journals, etc. Not anyone can get their stuff published. There's you know, peer reviews, things where people are stopping the substandard stuff from getting through. Nowadays, anything can get through, and whatever happens to draw attention, then people start to, you know, pull themselves up by their own numbers and creating authority for themselves, regardless of the actual content they produce.
I have one last question, Dr. Truman. Camden and I have talked a lot recently about the use of media, because we use it and we see it as a good thing. I probably blog less hours in a day, not much at all anymore, and even this show doesn't take up much time. I probably spend a whole lot less time than the normal pastor does, who watches sports or television 7, 8, 10 hours a week. I'm not faulting anyone for that, but we don't use it a whole lot. We want to use it more, and we've talked about the benefit of linking up with others. We've created this network where we bring other men in who we think can offer something substantial. We're careful about who we bring in, what we want to be. What are your thoughts about men joining together to do things with media? I mean, it seems when I think about the Reformation, you know, Luther, we often break these men up as if they were laboring alone, but they weren't. And they were meeting together, and they were in some way working together, weren't they? And I guess that's my first question. And then the second would be, do you think it would be beneficial to see more like-minded men coming together to work together in the use of media, the internet, and other things in the church?
I think an emphatic yes to both questions. So one of my favorite things to listen to when I'm traveling in the car is The White Horse Inn. Mm-hmm. And there you've got four guys with, you know, slightly different perspectives on things, but enough commonality to be able to put forward coherent arguments as a foursome. But it's just fun listening to them talk and bounce ideas off each other. I think it's a great piece of ecumenism, media ecumenism, if you like, to right. do that. And it conveys good and helpful information, because even when you disagree with something the guys say, it helps to clarify your own opinions. So I do think those sort of team efforts where you've got a variety of opinion on display, very, very helpful for clarifying and sharpening ideas.
Mm, that's helpful.
And that's good. Yes.
Dr. Truman, we must chalk one up for ecumenism today, because you and I, solid OPC guys, and we are being very ecumenical in spirit with Nick, who is
yes.
of the PCA.
Yeah, I'm yes. happy to slum it once in a while.
I mean, oh, ouch.
Well, all you PCA guys, you should know Dr. Truman does nothing but rip on the OPC in class. But so we get our share of it from one of our
yeah, but can I just say, not in any way that would get me into trouble with
no,
the
No, no,
it's
all in good fun. Nothing obscene. Nothing like the posters of the internet, or the posters of the Reformation. Nothing like that. Well, Dr. Truman, we want to thank you for joining us. This has been a great discussion. I think it will open the minds of some people, and I just wanted to provide a different angle on some of this discussion. And given that it was, you know, time for the Reformation Day again, I thought this was a great opportunity in order to see our current age in the light of Luther and what was going on back then. So thanks for spending time with us this afternoon.
Well, thanks very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Well, I want to let everyone know about Dr. Truman's books you can pick up. I'll just list a few of them. The Wages of Spin, an excellent collection. Critical Writings on Historic and Contemporary Evangelicalism. John Owen, Reformed Catholic and Renaissance Man. And also, why don't you take a look at Luther's Legacy, Salvation and English Reformers, 1525 through 1556. You can also listen to Carl Truman's other appearances on Christ the Center. He was on episode 42, and he spoke about the history of Trinitarian thought. That was actually recorded at Nick's old house, so a very fun discussion. And also episode 54 with Greg Beale on the erosion of inerrancy in evangelicalism. So take a look at those, or I should say take a listen to those two episodes. You can visit Nick at feedingonchrist.com, and you can check out everything that we're doing, including audio versions of Calvin's Institutes. We're publishing sermons every Sunday now, as well as Christ the Center and the Reformed Media Review. All that fun stuff at reformedforum.org. And finally, if you want to get a hold of us, please send us a voicemail at 440-97-FORUM, or you can mail us at mail@reformedforum.org. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you'll join us again next time on Christ the Center.